Hi, and welcome to Five Compelling Questions with Sean. This is the podcast where we speak with writers about writing. And I have a return guest again today. I'm so excited to have Erica Miner back on the show. How are you doing, Erica?
I'm doing great, and I'm just as excited, if not more.
Yes, we are. Well, we had fun time seeing each other in San Diego at BatcherCon. And I haven't seen you since, so Happy New Year. Even though it's getting kind of late in January to say Happy New Year, it's only the first part of January, but Happy New Year. Happy
Happy.
2024.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you. All
I'm
right,
so.
I'm going to introduce you again.
Okay.
Erica, but yeah, because you have a really cool bio. After Erica Miner, after 21 years as a violinist with the Metropolitan Opera, Erica Miner turned to her lifelong love of writing as her creative outlet. Based in the Pacific Northwest, she is now an award-winning author, a screenwriter, arts journalist, and a lecturer. As a writer lecturer, Erica has given workshops for Sisters in Crime, Los Angeles Creative Writing Conference, Epic Group Writers, Write on the Sound, Fields, and Writers Community, Savvy Authors. That sounds good. Savvy Authors, and numerous libraries on the West Coast. See, and I put the head add this on because it's so exciting. You're going to be the keynote speaker at the Seattle Ladies Music Club this March. That'll be fun.
They just reached out to me. I guess I'm getting known around here finally. And I thought, what a perfect combination. I just get to talk about how I went from being a violinist to a writer and, get some lunch in addition to that. What could be better? Get people to know me.
Yeah, and you get to say that you've been a keynote speaker, and that's kind of a that's a it's a it's an I was just a keynote speaker in November. I actually got to do my own keynote at a convention, and that was it's very cool. It's an honor. It's kind of fun to be able to say that you've been a keynote. Have you been a keynote before, or is this your first one?
This is technically, I think, my first one that it's been named as such. I've done something similar for, the local college here in my area of Seattle, but just for them to say, "Oh, you're the keynote speaker," I'm like, "Okay, cool, I can do this! Yay!"
Yeah, it's awesome. There's pressure, and but it's fun. It's a lot of fun. I mean, I definitely would like to do some more. So it was a cool, it's a cool gig. It's a cool gig. So we're here to talk about your books. So what do you want to talk about today? Which book you want to talk about? The newest one?
I'd like to talk about the newest one, but also how I evolved from the first one to this current one and going into the third. So kind of all of them.
Yeah, and I have one of those. I have a question involving that. So the newest one is Aria for Murder. Yeah,
Prelude to Murder.
Prelude to Murder. So Aria for Murder was the first one. They're all
Yes.
so beautiful. They're all wrapped up in my mind as one big story because I am your editor.
And also
So
you created those gorgeous covers that everybody continues to love all the time.
oh. Thank you. I do love doing that. The covers are a lot of fun, and yours are exquisite. I do not. I'm not complimenting myself. Because there would not be a book, not be a cover without the book. So they just kind of magically go together. I think there's some kind of magic element to them, but they are very pretty, and they go perfectly with the book. So,
Do
me
they?
too. Me too. Me too. All right. So I don't want to preempt my question. So I'm gonna start with number one, because you're basically gonna answer it because I know what you're gonna say. You've written two books in your series, and you're working on the third. How has writing the subsequent books in the series differed from writing the first? Or you can expand on that as you were about to say, the evolution of the series.
Well, I wanted to begin by saying that I've discovered in this process that opera houses are a perfect place for mischief. There's so much that can go wrong. And so I started with that premise in Aria for Murder. And not to say that it wasn't a huge challenge, it was, but because I was setting that to take place at the Metropolitan Opera, where I was a violinist for 21 years, that made it a little bit easier because I didn't have to really do too much research. I remembered the place. You don't forget a place like that, especially when you've been there that long. And so it was relatively straightforward. I knew the place inside out. I could write from my own experience and recall of all those dark corners and back stairways that were so mysterious and dangerous and exploit that danger during the book. So that was fairly easy to put together. I did have to do a little bit of research in talking with some of my colleagues about what were the changes that might have taken place in the look of the place since I had been there. But basically, I kept it the way I remembered it. But then in the second book, I had to invent whole new dangers in a place that I didn't know. And how that came about was that one of my readers of the first book, who also happened to be an opera maven. He really, really loved opera, and he loved the book. And he said, okay, when's the sequel? And I really hadn't thought about that. He said, oh, no, you must write a sequel, and you have to set it at Santa Fe Opera. Well, I found that absolutely irresistible. Santa Fe, first of all, the city of Santa Fe, its history and its culture are unique. This opera house is unique. An opera house in the middle of the desert, there's just nothing else like that. And plus, Santa Fe has more ghosts than any other city in the US. So it seemed like the perfect environment. And I said, oh, absolutely, yes. The problem was I had never been there. So I had to familiarize myself, but I was very lucky because, you know, the opera world, we say that it's very incestuous. Everybody knows everybody all over the world, and especially in this country. You know, if you've been at the Met, then you'll meet someone who knows the Met. And as it happened, one of my very close friends for a long, long time had been somebody who was a very key part of the Santa Fe Opera, David Holloway, who actually ended up writing the foreword for Prelude to Murder. And so I got in touch with him, and he said, oh, yes, yes, I can provide you access to the entire opera house, which he did. He kept to his promise. I went out there for a week. He introduced me to everyone, including the general director, the conductor, the costume director, all of these people who ended up actually being key characters in the book. So I was inspired by that. And it was very different from the first, because I had to look into the history of the company and find out which operas they had performed over the years, over the decades, and decide which ones were the bloodiest and most violent of all that would provide the perfect backdrop for this mysterious mystery that's going to be taking place in an atmosphere that for the protagonist is like being a fish out of water, going from a New York City gal to the middle of the desert. But also this opera house, first of all, it's gorgeous. It's absolutely stunning. It's outdoors. It's set between two mysterious mountain ranges, one of which is called Sangre de Cristo, or the Blood of Christ. You know, you've got that, you've got the ghosts. So that was much different to write, because I had to do all that research. And but it was so much fun. The place is really amazing. And so that's when, after a week of that immersion, my wicked imagination took over, and voila, I created a plot that was set against these four operas that were so bloody and violent. So that really worked, but it was quite different than the first one. And so for the third one, I'm taking our protagonist to the San Francisco Opera, which is one of the creepiest opera houses you can imagine. And again, I had friends in the company, one in particular, who took me on a tour of the entire place, introduced me to all the right people. And I found out that there were weird things running underneath the opera house, all this kind of thing. There was a stagehand who claims to have seen a ghost up there in the nether world, you know, of the stage. And so that was a whole different experience. Again, I did a lot of research on the history of the company, which was tied in with the history of San Francisco and the gold rush and all of that kind of stuff. And so it was so much fun, but also it was a very different kind of operatic background, because I'm using the very famous four-part ring cycle of Wagner. A lot of people know about those operas. And so that story plays out against the stories of the operas, and it all ties in a much different way. So they've all been very different. They've all been incredibly fun. And I think the biggest challenge is to be showing the protagonist's transformational arc from one book to the next.
Now, and that is my question too. So yes. Are you cheating? You're cheating.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm teasing you.
It was inevitable.
Yeah, we're vibing. It's like the flow of the conversation. But you know, I like to kid. That's my thing. Okay, number two. That's the question. How has your main character evolved and developed through the book so far?
I created a protagonist named Julia Kogan, and the series is named for her, the Julia Kogan Opera Mystery Series. She starts out at the Met very much like me. She's a neophyte. She's starry-eyed. She hasn't a clue about all the political rivalries, the huge egos, lethal jealousies among this company members who number in the thousands, as a matter of fact, because it's a venerable institution. You wouldn't guess that anything untoward would be happening there. So by the end of that first book, Aria for Murder, she has learned that what really goes on behind the scenes, and she's thrown into a situation where she needs to draw upon an inner strength she didn't know she had. And she's quite young, so it really is a challenge for her. Plus, she has to perform perfectly because that's what's expected at the Met. The Met is the most prestigious opera house in the world. Then something terrible happens and she finds herself involved in a murder investigation, which is totally something she never would have expected. You know, she's kind of this hothouse flower who's practiced violin all her life. And so it really has been a lot of fun to develop her character, because one of the beauties of fiction is that you get to create characters who, if they are similar to yourself, they can have characteristics that I could never dream of having. I mean, yes, she's a very talented violinist, but also she's very smart and brave and plucky in ways that I never could be. So that's how she evolves from the beginning to the end of that particular book, where she ends up being a target of the killer, and spoiler alert, she survives because there's book two. Now in book two, she's thrown into a situation where she, as I mentioned before, a total fish out of water, but she's also called upon to play a key role, and that is of concertmaster of the Santa Fe Opera. And for people who don't know what the concertmaster does, the concertmaster is the most important person in the orchestra, the first of the first violinists. And if you've ever been to a concert of a symphony orchestra, you'll notice that the concertmaster, who sits right at the front, right next to the conductor's podium, gets up and tunes the orchestra before the performance. So the concertmaster signals to the oboe to give the note A, and then the strings tune to it, and then the winds and brass tune to it to make sure everybody's starting on the right pitch. But aside from that, if something goes wrong, the concertmaster, like for instance, something goes wrong on stage and the conductor is consumed with that particular problem, trying to avoid a train wreck, it's the concertmaster who everybody's looking to keep everyone together, and to, you kind of have to lead with your body, as a matter of fact. In fact, there was one situation, and I remember it, and at the Met, we had the most wonderful concertmaster. He was just our rock, you know, he just never, never failed. And there was one situation where the conductor actually got lost in the middle of a performance, and our concertmaster, Ray Neva, got up and started conducting with his bow to keep everything from falling apart. That's the kind of thing a concertmaster has to do. So Julia, having had only 1 year of experience under her belt, although at, you know, the very important Met, has been hired to be concertmaster of this major opera house. So already she's under a huge amount of pressure and is running into conflicts with the conductor and other people in the orchestra who resent her being there because she's new and she's young and all of that. And then when the operatic chaos and mayhem starts to happen, pretty much as soon as she gets there, she has to also deal with one of her friends being accused of the murder and getting involved in the investigation. And plus she's being pursued by ghosts, and she does not like ghosts. So that makes it very difficult, but she's up to the test because she's plucky and brave and courageous and smart. So she manages to get through that situation with flying colors, except at the end of Prelude to Murder, there's a cliffhanger where something happens in her life that will totally change everything about her life. No spoiler alerts here, but she has to deal with this surprise situation, and everybody at the end is wondering, how is it going to happen in book three? So that'll be interesting to see how she matures into that situation as well.
Yes, and we all cannot wait. And everything will be revealed the end of 2020. Well, fall of 2024, I believe. Fall 2024, is that correct?
It's October.
I was right. See, I kind of have, we have a lot of people. So I'm going to.
Oh, you certainly do.
We certainly do. All right. Question number three. Well, that is lovely. Everyone is excited, and we can't wait to see where she moves from here. So in addition to your keynote, I noticed on your website when I was looking you up today, you're giving a series of talks on Shakespeare and the operas influenced by his work, which is very cool. Has Shakespeare or any other author had any influence on your own writing? This has got me thinking. I'm like, well, you obviously must know a lot about Shakespeare if they're asking you to talk about it. So has that been an influence or not? Who has been?
It depends on the writing. As far as my mystery series is concerned, it's less Shakespeare and more other authors like my idol Agatha Christie, who I'm in such awe of her, of having been so prolific at a time when it was not easy. I mean, I don't think it's ever easy for a women author now more than ever, but back in her time, in the early 20th and mid 20th century, being a woman and being that successful and prolific. And yes, of course, she went through a lot of difficulty in her life, and she still managed to publish more books than anyone and to be the one author whose books there are more copies of in circulation and been published than any other book in history except the Bible. I mean, how could you not be in awe of that? And plus, her brilliance in writing style, in creating plots, in the way she weaves everything together and makes every plot point come out of every plot point before and lead to the inevitable end. And I have to admit that in most cases, I can't guess who the perp is. She is so brilliant at setting the stage and at red herrings and at throwing all these clues at you so that you get to like, well, it had to have been so and so, but no, actually, it probably was so and so. And so she keeps you guessing. And that's something that I aspire to in writing my mysteries. And a lot of people say that, oh, I didn't know until the end. And that's exactly what I aspire to do. And it's more than anyone else, Agatha Christie, who's inspired me to do that. So I'd say that's my primary influence. A brilliant woman mystery writer. How could you go wrong?
Absolutely. And they're still, 30 years from now, they're going to be making new movies out of her books. And it's just the way it's going to be. Because,
Yes,
she's
yes.
it's evergreen. It's just, new generations are constantly rediscovering. I just took my mom to see the most recent, the Tina Fey, Kenneth Branagh, and it was good. And we enjoyed it. We had a really good time. It's a, she's a great inspiration. She definitely is, for sure. That's a good choice.
That's
You're gonna,
it's
you're just, yeah, if you're gonna
solid.
be inspired by anyone, that's the one you should pick. All right, number four. Do you find similarities between writing and performing music? Because you are an accomplished musician, obviously. Is there any combination of those two? Does one come easier to you than the other?
I think there are absolutely similarities between writing and performing music. And true confessions, I don't find that either one comes easy. I find that I'm good at them, but there's nothing easy. I chose two, different kinds of professions that are both very difficult, but I think that writing and being a performing musician do have a lot in common. They're both unique art forms, and they both involve great creativity, but also great discipline. Constant perfecting. You're constantly trying to perfect your violin playing. You're constantly trying to perfect your writing. And as I mentioned in our previous podcast, I first started writing actually before I started playing the violin when I was in grade school, when I was growing up in Detroit, believe it or not, back then, 100 years ago. There was actually a fantastic public school system with after school programs, and I was placed in one for creative writing. So that passion for writing was created in me at about age 7 or 8. So then I started playing the violin. Both of them felt natural to me, but I actually found writing to be a lot more fun because honestly, the violin is just the most difficult instrument. It's so difficult. You have to just pretty much put everything else aside so that you can play this fiendishly difficult instrument at that very young age. And it turned out that I had a talent for it and I was very good at it, but it was never easy. It was actually easier just to play something on sight for the first time than to go back and practice and perfect it. I really, really hated practicing. A lot less fun than writing. I actually enjoy the whole process of writing and rewriting and rewriting. Somehow creating my own words comes more naturally to me than perfecting the notes that some other composer has written. I know it's kind of a true confession. I generally try not to tell people this, but it's true. And so bottom line, neither one is easy, but at this point in my life, the writing is a lot more fun than the practicing of the violin ever was. So I'm doing something that I really love to do. But both of them, yes, they're definitely related, definitely similar kinds of discipline, and definitely rewarding in very similar ways as well.
Oh, I love that. That is so, you just put that so eloquently, and it's truth. And it's because I would like, you know, I play violin kind of at a high level for that age. And yeah, I didn't like practicing either. I did not want to. I would pretend that I was doing it, but I would really be reading books. Agatha Christie. So we have a lot in common, and it wasn't definitely not 100 years ago.
I didn't realize
it was Detroit. That's pretty cool that they had those opportunities for you up in. I didn't know you were from that area. That's pretty fun.
Well, Detroit is an amazing place. There were so many talented young musicians there. There was a lot of competition. So it was a great environment to grow up in, at least back then.
Oh, yeah. Like Motown. I mean, it's huge. You know, music is, it seems like it's in the water up there. So that's awesome.
Probably is.
Well, you've written other kinds of things. You're very accomplished. So my fifth question is, if you could tell your younger writing self anything, what would it be?
I think I would tell her that you shouldn't let one creative outlet preclude the other. So when I started playing the violin, I felt like, as I mentioned, I could not give justice to the instrument and focus on writing at the same time, which was really kind of sad. Not that I ever stopped writing. I kept taking writing classes even while I was at the Met whenever I could fit them into my schedule. But when I was a kid, and I started writing and playing the violin, I realize now that each one adds to the other. Each one feeds the other. Music and writing go hand in hand. So now that I'm a mature person with decades of experience, I think of myself as having gained wisdom over the years. And I realize I can be creative in different ways at the same time, which also has to do with my lecturing. Some people say to me, how can you be doing lectures and writing books at the same time? They're just both just so intertwined with each other. So music was definitely my first love. Since I was born, I remember that there was always classical music playing in my house all the time. My father was my first violin teacher. Music was my life, and I started singing and dancing and all that kind of thing as an early age. But creating characters and plot lines and weaving them all together to tell stories, there is a passion that has stayed with me my entire life and hopefully will stay with me forever. I feel like I have so many stories to tell. I could not possibly live long enough to tell them all. And so I want to write as many of them as I can while I can. So I think that, again, music and writing, they're interrelated so wonderfully. A friend of mine who does a radio broadcast called Opera for Everyone in, of all places, Wyoming, in Jackson Hole, but she really knows opera inside out. And she said to me, the only thing better than a great story is a great story with music. And that whenever I think of that, it just gives me goosebumps. It really says it all, you know, music, writing, stories, opera. It's all one of a piece, and it's all part of my passion that I just can't let go of. And I think I feel very blessed to be able to be having those as my creative outlets.
Yeah, absolutely. Mine are food and music and writing and movies. That's what I like to do. They're my things, but it's similar. I have to throw food into everything. You know me. Well, you did great on the first five. Awesome. We have a new quiz. This is season 3. This is the third year of the podcast. It is 2024. We are moving into new things. So ready. We're going. Number one. Do you prefer reading standalone novels or series?
I actually like both pretty much equally. It depends on the characters and the plots. If it's a character that I really relate to, that I find really compelling, then yes, I'll want to continue with the series. But generally, I'm pretty happy with standalones as well. You know, it just, any story that grabs me, whether it's part of the series or it's just a one-off, it's all good.
Yeah. Have you ever read a standalone and then wished you could read more about that part? Like, you wish there was another book. Have you ever done that? That's happened to me a couple times.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, number two, we prefer reading books set in contemporary times or historical.
I have to admit, I'm a pushover for period stories, whether it's fiction, historical fiction in movies and TV, all of that kind of thing. I just get hooked on it. Whenever my husband always makes fun of me, whenever there's a new Masterpiece Theater series, he just assumes that he'll never see me again, you know, because I get so hooked. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because, you know, one of my favorite other authors is Charlotte Bronte, or even or George Eliot or Jane Austen, all of that stuff. Somehow when I read a period piece, it just takes me back. And I feel like either I lived as another person in an incarnation in that time, or there's something about the time where I wish I could live in times like those, where things seemed simpler and more straightforward, and you could focus on people more than on media. This is a terrible thing to say, but I just find the 18th, 19th century, it's irresistible. I just love it. I love the idea of imagining myself in those costumes, you know, the bonnets and the carriages and all that great stuff. I'm just a sucker for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I was thinking about how they often show like how they had to get dressed. It's taking forever just to get dressed. And yet, like, you don't have that much to do the rest of the day. So
exactly. And you have to have assistance, of course.
Yeah, you have to have help getting those buttons done and up your back.
Yep.
Number three, do you prefer to write in the mornings or evening?
Absolutely in the morning. That's when I'm fresh. That's when I have more concentration. My concentration tends to run out of steam as the day goes along. So by mid to late afternoon, I'm useless. So I know that. So it's weird too, because when I was a musician, I was such a night person. I had to be, because sometimes performances would go until midnight, and then you'd be wired when you get home, and then you had to be up the next morning for rehearsal. So now that I don't have to do that, I try to get up early in the morning, get all my other stuff out of the way, exercise, whatnot, those disciplines. And then I allow myself the privilege of sitting down and writing, and my ideas are fresher and my concentration is much better. So yeah, that's a no-brainer for me.
Very good. You sound like you're very disciplined. That sounds good. You're not just winging it. Would you rather watch a movie or a TV show?
Now that is a really difficult question, because I do love watching both, but I've also written screenplays in both of those genres. And so I have to say that even though I love watching both a really great TV, especially series, I'm hooked on series, and movies. There are some great movies like The Oppenheimer, which I just saw, which just blew me away. But when it comes to writing a screenplay, it's a very clear choice. Writing a full-length movie is much more appealing to me than writing a TV script. And it comes down to the fact that it's like writing a logline or a synopsis is actually in some ways more difficult than writing an entire story, because when you have to distill it down to just a few lines or a paragraph or a few paragraphs, it's really difficult to do that. The same holds true when you're writing screenplays. To write something like a TV script of a 1.5-hour show is actually, for me, more difficult than writing an entire full-length screenplay. It's a different kind of discipline. It's a different kind of thought process. It's all really challenging, though, and I really love doing it. So when I'm watching TV or when I'm watching a movie, all of that is kind of running around in my head. I'm analyzing as I go along, which is a terrible thing. But yes, I do love both.
Yeah, me too. I think I might know the answer to number five. If you could have dinner with any author, living or dead, who would it be?
Well, it comes back to Agatha. There's no question. There actually has been, speaking of series, there's been a series on PBS, the Agatha Murder series, where it's fictionalized version of certain key episodes in her life, where she actually, in one of them, she actually goes somewhere to solve a murder mystery, you know, this kind of thing. And I think that the actor or actress who plays her is absolutely excellent. And of course, it's British because, you know, getting back to Shakespeare, the Brits do this better than anybody. They've got Shakespeare in their genes, you know, running through their veins. So it's very well done. And it makes me think about, wow, she must have been so fascinating. And she had so many great ways of expressing herself, but she also had a lot of self-doubt. She was very, very, had all these human characteristics. And so I would just sit her down and in my fantasy, I would cook her a meal that isn't English, because the English aren't known for their great cuisine. And I'm married to a French guy, so I know a little bit about that. So I'd provide her with an incredible meal and a lot of great French wine. And we'd talk about, how did you do this? You know, where did your inspiration come from? How did you manage to buck the whole, you know, anti-female professional world that you were working in? You know, there's an episode where she actually goes to see Sherlock Holmes and asks him a literary question. And of course he dodges it completely. But, you know, I'm thinking of, in a man's world, how did you do that? And could you give me some inspiration to keep going so that I can do this too? And again, there's the parallel between the music world and the writing world. When I first started out, they didn't hold audition behind screens. And so most of the orchestra were mostly men. As soon as they started holding auditions behind the screen, suddenly there were all these women in the orchestra. How about that, you know? But you still had an enormous amount of bias against you. And so I would love to be able to pick her brains about, how did you deal with that? How did you keep going? You know, did you have this inner strength you didn't know you had? All these questions I would love to ask her over dinner.
That's and a perfect dinner. Yeah, that'd be a perfect dinner date. And that would be so interesting to hear her replies to that. That, because it, you know, I hadn't really thought, you know, she's just so great. You kind of forget the struggles I'm sure she went up against, you know, so that is fascinating. My mom gave me a screen with my name. That's why she wanted to name me a name that could be a man's name as well. Because she wanted me to be able to apply for a job and not be automatically put in the other pile. So she gave me a man's name. But it worked a couple times, I know for sure, because one guy kept talking about it. I really thought I was calling a man. I'm like, is that a problem for you? He's like, oh, no, you have a great resume. But I have a feeling he would have, my name was Samantha or something, he would have just been like, oh, let me see who the next guy is on my, you know, on my list. But I thought that was really, she made that decision back in 1971. She's like, I wanted you to be anonymous as far as your gender for applying for jobs or colleges or anything, you know.
That's amazing. I love that.
Yeah, she made a point of it. She told me about it because I was like, Mom, why do I have a guy's name? Because all my friends are like Jenny and Missy and Chrissy and, you know, Colin. But love it now. Love it now. When I was a little girl, I was a little like, oh, yeah, it's cool now.
Yeah, when I was growing up, no one was named Erica and no one could pronounce it. And the only reason I was named that was because my parents heard a famous violinist, one of the few famous female violinists back then 100 years ago, Erica Marini, play on the radio before I was born. And they said, okay, if it's a girl, we'll name her Erica. And I grew up really hating it. But now it's definitely, I own it now.
Yeah, it's a great name. I like it that, you know, the names that are, you've heard them before, but they're unique. You know, like, we named our son Russell, which is like a classic name, but it's not overly used. It's not everyone has it. But, and I just assumed, I asked her, I said, well, I guess you just had one name for whatever I would come out being. Goes, oh, no, we were going to name you Ryan if you're a boy. So we like specifically picked Ashawn for a female. So it's nice. Just kind of funny. Yeah. So, well, it's been lovely. So tell us what's going on now. I know you're on the road speaking, you're a keynote, you're doing Shakespeare talks, you're just out there doing everything. Do you have a title for the next book we can look forward to hearing about?
I do, and I have decided not to reveal it yet.
Okay.
Although
Ooh,
I won't
you're
tell
being.
you exactly what it is, of course, because you're my editor. But yeah, it's definitely related to the first two titles. And I'm really excited because there's a new character in the series who is going to be very, very key to Julia, to the entire plot. And I can't wait to, you know, dive into writing her. And so it's all terribly exciting, and I feel like you know, I better get down to it's not like I never stop, but I always feel like, you know, a little bit of panic now and then about, you know, all of the wonderful lectures that I get to do, but those are a lot of work, and writing the book, which is mostly sheer pleasure, is still a lot of work too. So I'm not going to quit, but interestingly, this evening I'm going to be on another podcast streaming live with Sarah Burr. It's called The Bookish Hour.
Oh yeah, I've heard of it. It's a good show. It's very good. I like it a lot. And with Jim too, Jim Kenny, JC Kenny. Is he on there still too?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's going to be streaming live on YouTube at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific tonight. And so I think it's probably, if you just go either on her Facebook page, Sarah E. Burr, or The Bookish Hour, you'll be able to find it. It also will be recorded, and I'll post the link on my Facebook page. But yeah, I'm excited about that, to see what kinds of questions she's going to ask, because she didn't give me a clue yet. It's all going to be spontaneous. So, but I, you know, I love doing this, as you can tell. I'm such a ham, and my inner performer continues to stay happy as long as I can. I'm writing, always writing, but if I can get out there and express myself, you know, as a performer, which I miss doing because, you know, I don't play the violin anymore. So here I am, able to get out there and talk to you and talk to other people, and it's all good. I feel very blessed.
Well, we're very blessed to have you. So enjoy The Bookish Hour. That'll be fun. And that is a great show for everyone listening. It's a YouTube show, and Sarah is an amazing guest. She's a lot of fun. She's very generous to other writers. She's always doing things for other writers, and I always think pays you back 3,000 times over. So she's awesome. Everyone
Yes.
should look her up. Well, enjoy that. And I cannot wait to read the next book. And everyone can find you at ericaminor.com. And you're on all the socials, so everyone needs to run out and get the Julia books, Aria for Murder and Prelude to Murder. They're wonderful, and look at those covers and think about us when you're reading them. So
Thank you.
Have fun, Erica. I'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks so much, Sean. It's been an absolute joy, as always.
Thank you.